Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has reconvened. The Honorable Chief Justice Jill Karofsky presiding. Your silence is commanded.
Thank you, everybody. Good morning, and please have a seat. To do some welcomes before we start today, I'm super excited about the first one. I'm excited about all of them. Extra excited about the first one, and it's Madison West High School. If you're here for Madison West, will you please stand up? Welcome, Regents. My kids both went to Madison West, so I'm glad that you're here to join us today. Thank you. Go ahead and have a seat. We also have Monticello High School. Will you please stand up? Welcome. We're glad that you are here today as well. And the last I have is Faith Christian School in Randolph in the back. Thank you all for being here. I'm glad that you're all here to see how the third branch of government works. You all can have a seat. I'm not going to make you stand the whole hour. Be a true test of endurance, however. At the end of our oral argument today, Justice Protasiewicz is going to be available to speak with you, talk to you about how the court works and answer any questions that you might have. So I hope that you have time to stick around and do that when we are done here. I will call our second case of the morning. It is Racine County versus RPL. And could I start with the appearances? You say Robert. Thank you. And good morning to both of you. I have 25 minutes followed by 30 minutes and 5 minutes for rebuttal. Attorney August, whenever you are ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm honored today to be representing Robert, the person who, because of a medical incident, finds his liberty at stake in these protective placement. I'm here today to talk about two important and fundamental components of our protective placement system. First, the statutory elements, that is, the strict and stringent requirements set forth by our elected representatives in the legislature. And second, the constitutionally significant burden of proof, the requirement that the county prove those elements by clear and convincing evidence. And as we'll discuss today, this is a meaningful burden. It requires the county to present real evidence, real proof at these annual hearings. In this case, the evidence is clear that the county failed to prove two things. First, dangerousness, as set forth in 55081C, and second, the permanency of Robert's disability under sub D. I'd like to start our conversation today with dangerousness, just because in reviewing the case law and thinking critically about the statutory scheme, I think dangerousness is where the action lies. Dangerousness is the critical component, the part of the proceedings that justifies the otherwise intense liberty restrictions at issue.
Counsel, actually, I want to just actually, before we even get to that, just talk a little bit about the standard of review questions in this case. And I wanted to know if you have any comment on the brief by the counties association talking about the maybe difficulties with the burden of proof here. And, you know, I think the points on dangerousness and permanence, what makes some of these really difficult questions is that the trial court is hearing evidence, sometimes competing evidence, but sometimes not. And then they make some certain findings on what appears to be kind of a very much a medical determination. Yet the standard of review for the Court of Appeals and for us is deferring to the trial court's factual findings, but reviewing sort of whether it meets the definition, you know, reviewing that de novo. And I don't know how you do that. I know that courts have been doing that, but I don't know how that works. And so I wanted to see if you have any comment about, what the county's said and any other just broader perspectives on the standard of review in these types of cases, which obviously impacts, you know, your client too. But
certainly. So I did read the brief by the amicus, which is, I read it, calling for the overruling of several decades of precedent from the Court of Appeals. I would note that there's no argument from the county in this case that the burden or the standard of review changed. I think both parties are in agreement here fully that this is a de novo review. And I think it's appropriate to have a de novo review because at the end of the day, what we're looking at is we're looking at statutory standards, and the court is making a legal determination as to whether those statutory standards have been met, such that the intrusive state action at issue here, in other words, involuntarily confining someone in a nursing home or even in a locked unit, is appropriate. And I think dangerousness is a really great example of this, because the legislature has set forth a very clear textual requirement for dangerousness. The legislature has indicated that it's not merely being kind of generic concerns or the like, that what needs to be proven here would be a substantial risk of serious harm. And that's a legal definition that's specific to protective placement, and that's what needs to be met. So I would agree that there's embedded factual findings in these cases, what has gone on historically, what medical events have happened. But whether there is, as the Court of Appeals precedent discusses, that foreseeable and specific harm that's been articulated, that's ultimately a legal question. And I think it's a question that this court is well suited to answer. And when we look specifically at dangerousness, which again, these are, you know, protective placement cases, and the legislature has made very clear that in balancing the competing interests, on the one hand, the person's rights and liberties, this kind of libertarian individualism, and on the other hand, a kind of collective paternalism, the need of our government to sometimes intervene for someone's own good. The way that we justify that intrusion is we need the presence of a real exigency or emergency. We need to do so in very clear and defined circumstances, when there is an actual risk, a substantial risk, that something bad is really going to happen but for that protective placement order. And the cases, I think, make this very clear, going back to the 1970s cases, the Zander versus Eau Claire case, as well as the 1980s case that I cited, the KNK versus Bueller case. They talk about how, you know, minor injuries, minor incidents, those are not sufficient. Speculation isn't sufficient. What we're talking about is a real foreseeable harm. Because again, we in our law, we usually let individuals kind of live life by their own lights. They're free to make their own choices, including medical choices and what have you. And it's really only once there's that clear and convincing evidence that this person is actually going to either harm themselves or they're going to harm someone else, that we are justified in overriding those interests and constructively, well, not constructively, but actually, you know, forcing them into a situation which they would not freely choose. I think that this.
So how specific do you think the testimony or evidence needs to be in regard to dangerousness? Is it your position that the county has to have a witness identify a specific risk? What's enough?
So the case law is clear that it does need to be specific. And I think thinking critically, a distinction here, the case that I cited in the brief that I think is really helpful, an unpublished case, but a persuasive case, is that Zebulon K case, which talks about this very troubling situation where you have these two intellectually disabled brothers who have evinced some desire to live alone together. And the community is concerned, how are they going to take care of themselves? And essentially what the Court of Appeals said is, look, just kind of being vaguely concerned, that's not a specific foreseeable risk. We need more definite evidence as to how and why this person or these people would become dangerous. And so we see this in a number of the unpublished. Again, if we're just talking about these kind of general or vague allegations, those aren't going to be enough. When we look at, for example, in Therese B., by contrast, a published decision of the Court of Appeals, there the concern was that the person had some desire to disconnect a pacemaker. Or we've seen in the DCR case that was discussed in the county's brief, that was the situation where the individual had the brain injury and had the desire to get a motorcycle and ride a motorcycle, even though it was clear that the person couldn't safely operate that and was risking further injury. We've seen other cases where, for example, if someone has, they're on medication for a recent organ transplant, and they have a history of not taking their anti-rejection medication in conjunction with drinking. That's a specific and foreseeable risk, because we know if they stop taking those medications, that's going to cause a serious harm to that person. But just saying that someone, oh, maybe they're not going to take care of themselves, or maybe their apartment's not going to be as clean, or some of these more generic assertions, those aren't sufficient to take away their rights and their liberty. And I think we need to be especially mindful of that in cases like this, where we are dealing with an older adult who had a single medical episode. Robert had a stroke, and by virtue of that stroke, he has lost all of his freedom. And I think that there are countless Wisconsinites, older adults, who face medical situations. But again, just because someone faces a medical situation or they have incapacities, we don't have the right to take custody of them.
Well, counsel, I just want to point to some facts discussed in the Court of Appeals decision in paragraph 11. The court talked about the testimony of Dr. Bram, who opined, you know, went through some of Robert's disabilities, partial paralysis, some cognitive impairments related to decision-making and communication, impairment of critical thinking. And the doctor offered his opinion that 24-hour supervision was necessary to assist him with activities of daily living, including remembering to take his medications. All that seems to me to present a pretty compelling case on dangerousness, that left on his own, he'd present a pretty significant risk to his own health and safety. Can you explain why it is that you believe that's inadequate here?
So a couple of points there. I think the place that I want to start with is the medication piece that you just pointed to, because I think the medication issue here is a great example of why this record is deficient. There's some claim in the circuit court's reasoning that medication is one way, or medication noncompliance is one reason that Robert will be dangerous. The problem is that the testimony from the hearing actually tells us that he is in fact compliant. So we have that piece of evidence. Second, I think it's really concerning here. We have a stroke victim. He's apparently being prescribed massive quantities of psychotropic medications. There's no explanation or any effort at this hearing to explain why these medications are being prescribed and what dangerousness those medications are alleged to prevent. So again, there's no linkage here as to if he stops these medications, he will become dangerous because they're preventing some sort of dangerous. Unlike in that scenario I discussed, for example, the anti-rejection medication.
Okay, so it seems to me, counsel, you're pointing to some conflicting evidence in the record suggesting that he is able to take his medications on his own and has been compliant. But why can't the trial court, who's the fact finder here and is making that ultimate determination on dangerousness, pick and choose among the evidence that's presented? Isn't that part of the trial court's job in a case like this? Mm-hmm. To resolve conflicts in the evidence.
So again, we're applying a de novo standard as to whether those elements have been met. And so I think when on appeal, we are looking at whether those standards have been met. We are looking at the totality of the evidence, and we are asking whether those standards. I think the medication piece is just really concerning because, again, we have a doctor who is asked directly and is unable to concretely make a prediction or opine whether or not Robert will continue to take the medication if he's not under protective placement. I would think that in order to find him dangerous, if medication is the issue, we would want the doctor to say, yes, if he is not under protective placement, he will not take the medication. The doctor cannot make that prediction. And in fact, again, we don't even know what the medication is for. We have no idea what is going on with Robert's medical situation besides the very vague and conclusory testimony that the examiner offered.
Counsel, go ahead, Chief. I'll follow up.
I just, on the medication question, I'm looking at the transcript from the hearing, and it seems like the concern is, he does seem to be taking his medication. There's some testimony about he's reluctant to do so, but he's still doing it, right?
Certainly.
Okay. But then it says, the question is, if he were in a, the question goes on to talk about a supported living situation where the medication was provided to him. And the testimony is, again, he probably would take that. But then the questioning goes to, would he likely continue to take his medication as he has been at the family home? And I'm at on page... Or 109-19 at the very bottom. But the answer then, if you want to get to that, I can wait a second. The answer to that is, well, it would be a different situation because his medication would be provided to him at a certain time if he's at the assisted living facility, but it might be different if he was at his home. So the reason I'm pointing that out is because I think it goes to what Justice Crawford is asking you is, you have some competing answers here. They're not diametrically opposed, but they're different. And isn't that what the fact finder needs to do as the judge in this case, as the person who is judging credibility and is in the courtroom, and that is in fact what the judge did here.
So again, I think that the court has the ability to make factual findings, but whether these standards, the dangerousness standard has been satisfied is a question of law that we review de novo. And I think the record in this case, again, is problematic because if we go to 109.23, the expert is asked directly, would he medicate himself voluntarily? I don't think I can answer that. That seems to be the dispositive question here. And again, like many of the other answers that the expert gave, the expert again and again and again is unable to give the information that I think we would want an expert to give in order to determine.
I'm going to just pick a small bone with you regarding the record, because there's another question after that. Yes. Just one question. The question is this. Just one question. Do you believe your client was living in his own, if he were living in his own home, would he medicate himself voluntarily? And then the answer you just gave, I don't think I can answer that. But then there's a follow-up question. Given that you testified that he does have some confusion about his medications, do you believe he would be able to do so safely even if he would take the meds? Answer, yeah, my opinion. My opinion has to do with the initiation factor that he would know that it was time and what to do if there was an error, like if he missed a dose, what would he do in those types of situations? So that's an example of how critical thinking skills could interfere with the whole process. So again, it's a little mushier than, yeah, I don't have a concern about whether or not he would take his meds. I'm reading this record as there's a possibility that there would be some problems if he were on his own.
But what the examiner never answers is what happens if he doesn't take the medication. That information is never provided to the court. So again, I think we can contrast that with cases where we're talking about medication, and medication is clearly designed to eliminate a risk. We have no idea from this record why this person with a stroke is being given these medications, what dangerousness they are designed to eliminate, and what would happen if he did not take them. And I think that that's essential if we're going to hold his lack of medication against him in order to find him dangerous. Because again, well, there has to be...
Counsel, it seems to me that whole area is a little outside of the scope of this kind of hearing, unless counsel for RDL had introduced some evidence about it or cross-examined the doctor to say he doesn't need any of these medications that he's on. Was there any effort to present evidence of that? Because otherwise, if I'm the trial court judge, I'm going to assume that the prescribed medications are necessary and helpful medications for him. I don't know why the trial court should be assuming that he's taking unnecessary medications.
So these are due process hearings, and these are hearings which are designed to ensure that the continued deprivation of liberty is appropriate and warranted under the standard. And I think in a situation where we're using the prospect that someone will not take medication as the basis to continue depriving them of their liberty, we need a better explanation of why the medication is being prescribed, what dangerousness it is intended to prevent, and what will happen if they do not take it, in addition to actual concrete evidence as to compliance or non-compliance, which we don't have. Again, this record is rife with uncertainty. It contains ample omissions. The examiner concedes that there is not even a thorough understanding of Robert's underlying medical issues and disclaims any knowledge of his medical history, evinces no ability to concretely make a prediction as to the permanence of that disability, and there's ample cross-examination that exposes the shortcomings of the examiner's otherwise conclusory testimony.
Counsel, your client stipulated to Easter Seals being appointed, correct?
I believe so.
And is there anything in the record to suggest what, if anything, Easter Seals did to attempt to maintain Robert in his own home, but provide him with resources or supports in order to maintain him there? Or did they not attempt?
There is nothing set forth at this annual review hearing regarding any of Robert's history. And in fact, I think a great example of this is speech language training. We have an examiner who concedes on cross-examination that if Robert is provided the speech language training that he needs because of his aphasia, speech language training that he apparently hasn't received in the intervening year despite being under Chapter 54 and 55 orders, that would, in the examiner's opinion, potentially reduce or eliminate the need for the protective placement. But again, that just simply hasn't been done. So we have a person, an older adult, who has a stroke, finds themselves totally at the mercy of this bureaucratic apparatus, and the people appearing at this hearing don't know anything about his history. They don't know the scope of his deficits. There's no testing done. There's no training done. And they can't make predictions about any of the things that the case law would seem to indicate that they should be opining on. And instead, what we're left with is these very conclusory averments about he has a disability and he needs some assistance. Well, I think number one, just the fact that someone has a disability doesn't prove that they're dangerous. In fact, the statutory language makes clear that there is a cause and effect relationship that needs to be proven. And in fact, I think it would be very troubling if we concluded that just because older adults have a medical situation or because someone is disabled, they are per se qualifying for protective.
Counsel, I know your time's running short. I don't know if you were here, Attorney August, for the first argument or not. We spent a lot of time talking about mootness. I want to talk to you about mootness in this particular case. Can you explain to me how 55045 fits into the mootness analysis, and does it impose a liability for cost of care?
So as to mootness, I think number one, the mootness issue has already been resolved in this case by virtue of this court's decision in Sauk County versus SAM, which no party in this case is asking to overturn. This court interpreted 4610 sub 2 as imposing a financial liability that evades mootness 4610 sub 2 also applies to protective placement orders. So under SAM, this case is not moot. But I think even if we look to 55045, which is the statute the county wants to focus on, I don't see a material distinction. Because what I see when I look at 55045 is another statutory mechanism whereby a person under a protective placement order becomes liable for costs of care. And as this court said in SAM, it doesn't matter whether the county has actually tried to collect. There's no requirement, as this court said in SAM, that the person actually come to court with receipts or with itemization. It's sufficient that there is a textual relationship, a statutory relationship here between that order and those costs of care. And so I think even if we set aside the binding holding of SAM and we look solely at 55045, that is another mechanism whereby the person is incurring that responsibility.
And wasn't Robert's home sold to pay for the cost of his care?
That's correct.
Right, but the language is different, may versus shall in 51 and 55, so it's a different standard.
The language is different, but again, this court in the SAM decision talked about, I believe it's, I don't want to get the P word wrong, it was either possible or potential liabilities. And again, it was sufficient that there was those potential liabilities, not that there was a concrete liability.
But here there actually was. His house was ordered sold.
His house was sold. That is correct.
So you sold.
Go ahead.
Do you have, is there anything in the record to explain why a neuropsych eval was not done? Easter Seals didn't request it. Robert's attorney didn't request it, because I'm sympathetic to your arguments that the record is sparse as far as an understanding of what Robert's deficits are. I mean, there's many people who struggle, and I don't need to go into that discussion with you, as I'm sure you appreciate it based on the work that you do. But this is, again, I'm very sympathetic to your arguments, because it is a big deal to deprive somebody of their liberty and take away their home, remove them from the home. And we have no real concrete understanding of we have the origin of his deficits, perhaps, but we don't have an understanding as of the time that this protective placement was continued of what that was specifically, and whether they could be remedied with proper treatment. So again, is there anything in the record about requests made for a neuropsych eval to gain a further understanding of his condition?
May I answer, Chief Justice?
Please.
So there is, as the county notes, I believe some discussion at this hearing immediately prior to the annual review hearing where there's reference to a neuropsych examination. The county indicates it's not asking the court to order one. It's not clear to me that the court would have to order an exam, again, for someone who is under a Chapter 54 order. I think what's clear here is the county's expert concedes that his opinion is impaired to some extent because he doesn't have that information. It's the county that is choosing to move forward with this annual review hearing in the state of the record that it is. It's the county that elicits that information that the opinion is impaired because of that lack of information.
Justice Dowd, did you say?
Yeah, thank you. Yes. You didn't touch on what I found maybe even more persuasive in terms of the factors here and the evidence supporting them, and that is the fourth factor about the individual has a disability that is permanent or likely to be permanent. So I wanted to give you a chance to comment on whether that has been proven or not.
So I think that this issue is relatively straightforward because the expert is asked to give that opinion. And I think the county was potentially expecting the concrete yes answer, and they didn't get it. The expert conceded that he was not able to make a prediction on that point. And if the situation is clear and convincing evidence, that's not clear and convincing evidence. And I don't know is not clear and convincing evidence.
What about the check mark in the report that the doctor had made?
So the circuit court did observe that the report was contradicted by the testimony. And I think when we're looking at just the check mark on a box versus the actual testimony where the doctor is given an opportunity to expand upon it, opinions and concedes in his testimony, essentially, I don't know or I can't make a prediction. I don't think that's overcome by perhaps just the routine box checking in this case.
Counsel, the statute requires a finding of either permanency or I think the word is likelihood of permanency. Can you discuss that? Because, you know, it's not a absolute finding. It's requiring some assessment of likelihood, is it not?
That's correct. And I don't even think that we have that finding or the sufficient evidence of likelihood in this case. Again, the examiner is unable to make the prediction. The examiner concedes that it's possible that his condition could improve. The examiner notes that there's at least some historical support for the fact that he has recovered from a similar incident previously. Although, again, as we know, there's nothing that the examiner can tell us about his medical history besides what he learned in the self-report. And essentially, that's really all we have. And I just don't think that that's sufficient under the standard set forth by the legislature.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chief Justice, good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Sarah Kidd, and I represent Racine County. RPL, who I will also refer to as Robert, challenges a 2024 order continuing his protective placement, which is now effectively expired. It's been superseded. I would like to address the issues of mootness and collateral consequences first, and then turn to the issues of standard of review and sufficiency of the evidence. The county asserts that Robert's appeal is moot, and there are no collateral consequences or exceptions to the mootness doctrine to make an otherwise moot case not moot. The appealed order, as the court's aware, has been superseded by the 2025 order continuing his protective placement. That was not a contested hearing. Robert stipulated in 2025 to a summary hearing before the court commissioner, and that order has not been appealed. If this court rules on the merits of Robert's appeal, there would be no practical effect in an underlying controversy because there is a live issue. And absent a live controversy, this court has acknowledged that a decision is, in effect, a decision on hypothetical facts or a pronouncement as an advisory opinion.
Counsel, in your view, are appeals from expired protective placement orders under Chapter 55 ever not moot? Or are they always moot?
In the context that's raised here, specifically cost of care liability, that's what's been asserted by RPL as what keeps it alive. The county's position, and there are several reasons I'd like to discuss why I don't believe the court's reasoning in SAM applies in Chapter 55 case. I think it's possible that this court would see a case where an exception has been raised. That's not the case. There certainly are exceptions to the mootness doctrine, but the sole basis to essentially rebut an assertion that it's a moot case here has been the cost of care liability.
And there's no even an exception in your mind based on the fact that his house was sold pursuant to this order, not the more recent one, and that those profits, assuming there was some, were used to pay for his care?
Well, I would like to follow up some about the specifics of that. So this was not a guardianship and protective placement action that was initiated by Racine County. This was an action that was initiated by counsel for a local hospital in Racine after Robert was admitted on an emergent basis after suffering a fall in his home and being located by a Meals on Wheels worker. So the county's only involvement at the time the petitions were initiated was the comprehensive evaluation, which is required by statute. As the courts noted, a corporate guardian was appointed Easter Seals, and it was Easter Seals, not Racine County, who filed the motion for the sale of his house. I would also push back some on the categorization that the sale of the house, the profits were specifically for cost of care related to his placement. I would also note his placement was not at a nursing home or a locked facility. It was at an adult family home with a smaller number of residents. And there was discussion by attorney for the guardian at this hearing who referenced specifically that there may be a need in a variety of capacities for the profits, one of which may be additional medical testing and programming to be made available to Robert by Robert and his medical decision maker, the guardian. So I don't think it's as a straight line to say the county filed a petition for protective placement, he was placed in a nursing home, and the house was sold to pay for nursing home care. That's, you know, I think when we dig into the facts of the specifics of Robert's care, it is more nuanced than that. And the guardian, counsel for the guardian, the corporate guardian, noted specifically that the taxes had not been paid on the house. There would be a risk of foreclosure at that point, that the house was not insured and there was a basis for liability.
Right, but still going back to, you're making an argument the cost of care liability doesn't apply here, that it's somehow not, it doesn't apply. That's what you're saying, why this isn't moot. So even if you're generally saying that somehow the same reasoning in SAM doesn't apply to a 55, even though they're both governed by the same statute, 4610, with respect to liability, even if we were to somehow accept that, in this particular case, the issue is, did he pay for his cost of care? Is he being charged for his cost of care? And it sure looks like he is.
Yes. I mean, I think as a practical matter, every individual subject to a 55 likely has some cost associated with that, you know, regardless of the type of placement. But in the context of whether that's a collateral consequence from a protective placement order, I would still assert that the answer is no. And in support of that, I would note that this court has consistently held that for an action to exist as a collateral consequence for an existing order, there has to be a causal connection. There has to be a tether between the order that's being appealed and the consequence that's being asserted. And the court discussed that reasoning in the context of a 51 in SAM. And this court specifically noted that the Chapter 51 order, the involuntary commitment order, was the sole basis for liability being imposed, and that but for the 51 order, were that order removed, the liability would be removed. So it was the but-for cause of that. When the court evaluates that assessment, and I understand 55 is referenced in 4610 sub 2, but when the court analyzes whether that assessment translates to a 55 case, I believe the answer is no, and there are several reasons. First, in a guardianship and protective placement case, there are always going to be multiple bases for the imposition of fees. A protective placement order can never exist without a guardianship order. And so when the court looks at the record here of the original orders, there were financial responsibilities related to the initiation of the petitions from the ward's income and assets, if sufficient, in both the guardianship and protective placement case. Additionally, corporate guardian fees were assigned. And so when the court is evaluating what cost exists and whether that's specifically because of the 55 order, I think the assessment doesn't translate in the same way that it does in a 51.
I'm not following you, because it seems like you are admitting or acknowledging that in the Chapter 55 context, that there are always costs of care that are going to be assessed against the subject of the protective placement and the guardianship order. So that completely militates against a finding of mootness here and maybe in every case, because there are always those collateral consequences to the order being enacted or adopted.
Yes, I do think that but for an individual being protectively placed in, for example, a private residence, which is pretty atypical, it is likely that there would be costs associated with a placement in a facility. However, I think the operative question is, if the court removes the 55 order, does that remove the cost and the liability? And I think the answer is no, that removing a 55 order can have no practical effect on the liability. In part, under 55, a guardian is allowed to place an individual voluntarily without court involvement in a facility less than 16 beds. Additionally, an individual, I think, is generally responsible for cost of care were they to reside in a nursing home or some other level of care that wasn't pursuant to a protective placement order. So here, if the court removed the protective placement order, Robert's corporate guardian could still, assuming he wasn't objecting at that time, still approve his residence in the adult family home, even without the order.
But counsel, that's not what happened here. The guardian did not take those steps, and instead we had a petition for a protective placement get filed. And he, Robert, objected to it. He did not want to be under this protective placement. So it seems to me that you're saying that even if we were to find that the protective placement order was unlawfully issued over his objection, involuntarily placing him, that he still has liability for the costs that he was forced to pay. Is that really your position?
And I want to make sure I'm understanding the question correctly. So if the 55 order was not in effect, that he would have been responsible for
if we were to reverse it.
Well, he, I think, is residing.
And he, assuming he paid something that he did not want to pay for this placement that he did not want and in fact objected to, would he be entitled to a refund of payments that he made?
Oh, I think it would probably depend on the location, I guess, that the cost came from, if it came.
So potentially, at least there could be costs that he paid that he could be entitled to have returned to him.
Yes.
Doesn't that make it not moot?
I still assert that I think the fact that a guardian, this order can exist, or this can exist with a guardian and Robert's residence in this type of facility without a protective placement order, obviates the cost associated with the protective placement action in 2020.
But we can't roll back the clock and choose that different legal path at this point, right? The, you know, woulda, shoulda, coulda, so other things could have happened, but they didn't.
I think it's also worth noting in the context of a protective placement action, that 55.045 specifically allows the county department and the circuit court to allow an individual's ability to pay, which is not true in a 51 context, and I think is a basis for this court to distinguish SAM's reasoning in a 51 from what's applicable here in a Chapter 55 case.
Is there an order in the record by the circuit court finding that he did not have an ability to pay?
There are standard state forms related to the final orders for guardianship and protective placement, and the circuit court will usually check either there's an award of costs for counsel and an award for the cost of the proceeding and the guardian ad litem, and the standard language on the form is from the ward's income and assets, if sufficient, and the court can either check or not check that. It was checked for costs here. It was not checked for the attorney costs. And there was also a later request from Easter Seals for fees related to the corporate guardian. Additionally, the practical effect of extending this court's reasoning in SAM to all 55 cases would be the functional elimination of the mootness doctrine in protective placement appeals. And there would be no capacity for moot appeals essentially to be eliminated from the system or addressed in that capacity, which would only cause further delays in the system. So the county's request is that the court determine the case is moot and decline to rule on the merits. But if the court does determine and a ruling on the merits is appropriate, the county's request is that the court affirm the Court of Appeals. And I'd like to address the standard of review. As has been noted, it's a mixed standard of review. The circuit court's factual findings are reviewed under a clearly erroneous standard, and the issues of whether the evidence satisfies the legal standard for incompetency and whether evidence supports protective placement are reviewed de novo. The county's position is that the Court of Appeals did appropriately apply a mixed standard of review that was not overly deferential to the circuit court's findings. As has been noted, WCA did file a proposed alternative standard. As has been noted by Robert's counsel, that wasn't a specific request by Racine County. Racine County didn't independently make that. I think it's a reasonable option if this court wishes to consider that proposal, but it wasn't an initiation from Racine County. And turning to the sufficiency of the evidence, as has been noted, in guardianship and protective cases, there is always a significant liberty interest, and those implicated in those types of actions are often the most vulnerable in our society. But the legislature has acknowledged that neither can we simply ignore or refuse to address the needs of individuals who may be unable to care for themselves for a variety of reasons. And so the county's position is that it's not a bureaucratic apparatus engaging in paternalistic behavior, but a social safety net preventing those who are unable to care for themselves because of a medical incident or other circumstance from suffering harm in a less restrictive setting.
And also, what really troubles me about this case, and I alluded to it with Mr. August, is that there was no evaluation done. So no one really had a clear understanding of Robert's deficits or how they would impact his ability to care for himself. I mean, the fact that he was found, I believe, inside his house, laying on the floor, I think he was dehydrated. That can happen to a lot of people for a lot of reasons, but the state doesn't come in and rip them out of their homes and then sell the home and put a person in out of home placement. So what troubles me the most is that there wasn't a neuropsych evaluation or really any evaluation done of Robert's deficits. And how could the county or his guardian determine what his needs really were? It seems like it was a reflexive, and I don't know how old Robert was at the time, but it sounds like it's an older individual, and the state stepped in and said, oh, you're old and there's no one around to help you, so we're going to rip you out of your home and put you somewhere. That doesn't sound right to me, especially if he had a condition that he could have received treatment for. And the guardian ad litem at the hearing said he could be evaluated again in the future using the neuropsych eval once he has worked on his communication skills with maybe some speech language therapy. But based on the record, it doesn't appear that his guardian got him that therapy. So he couldn't work on his speech, so he can't communicate, and here we are. And a second part question, just I want to make sure you address on the mootness argument. You're not arguing that the case is moot because he stipulated to the protective placement later, right? Because if we have an older individual who's been booted from his home and his house is sold, where is he supposed to go?
Addressing your second question first, that is not what I am asserting related mm-hmm. to stipulation. Related to the circumstances that he, in your first question, where he came into the system and his needs and the neuropsych eval, I would note that the method for a due process hearing is statutorily prescribed, and it's not an expert that Racine County obtains. It's a court-appointed expert. And Dr. Brahm, who was appointed by the court, is not an ongoing provider or medical treater for Robert. He was appointed for the specific purpose here. He did file a written report before the contested due process hearing in which he indicated, I think as the court's aware, that a neuropsych evaluation may be helpful. And as was referenced previously in the arguments, the county did note there was a brief due process hearing where there was a scheduling issue, and so it was ultimately adjourned. But the county did note at that hearing a couple weeks before this contested due process hearing that Dr. Brahm had specifically requested that and inquired if the court wished to order that, and the court declined to do so. And I would note on page 31 of the record, counsel for the guardian did specifically address the neuropsych eval, speech training, and what the guardian had attempted to do during the year, including related to the sale of the house and why the guardian was taking the actions they were. And ultimately, the attorney noted that the difficulties the guardian had stemmed not from the ward's speech difficulties, but from the unwillingness to comply. And they noted that the guardian had made routine efforts over that year related to other types of services and supportive options that Robert had declined to participate in. And as it relates to the county's involvement, the county is involved by statute in filing a petition for annual review of the protective placement order. But the county is not a medical decision maker for Robert. The county doesn't have the capacity to order him to participate in certain types of. So I think the county raised the issue to the court. He has a corporate guardian who I think had been attempting to do that. And I think the court, probably for the sake of judicial efficiency, is my suspicion, scheduled the hearing on the real estate sale and the due process hearing jointly. But those were separate, essentially, types of proceedings. And the county and the due process hearing were not involved in any capacity. The county made no request or representation.
And I don't mean to suggest that the county did something wrong or is responsible, but you're the one that's here defending the protective placement and the orders that the court issued. But the, well, I'll use the word again, deficits in the record suggest that perhaps there isn't enough factual basis to satisfy the statutory standards, particularly with respect to dangerousness, that Robert was so totally incapable of providing for his own care as to create a substantial risk of harm. That's what I'm getting at. It's not to attack the county's position or anything that you did or didn't do in the course of these proceedings, but there's a lack of record, if you will, on why the guardian didn't provide certain services or arrange for evaluations to be done of Robert so that the circuit court could make a fully informed decision.
Yes, addressing dangerousness and Dr. Brahm's testimony and report, I agree with the court that I think Dr. Brahm did not review past medical records or have access to that information, but I do think the record and his testimony indicates that in addition to his in-person contact with Robert, he did review collateral records, including two prior examinations, have contact with the staff at the adult family home, and review the relevant documentation related to the due process hearing. And Dr. Brahm testified that Robert suffers from a neurocognitive disorder secondary to a cerebrovascular accident. And the record, I think, is consistent that the incident in 2023 that precipitated these actions was believed to be a secondary cerebrovascular accident. And Dr. Brahm testified that there was ongoing right-sided paralysis, cognitive disorder, and aphasia, and that Robert continues to require assistance with multiple activities of daily living, including bathing, nutrition, medication planning, and initiation. And so ultimately, I think that's going to be a fact-specific analysis to some extent in terms of activities of daily living and to what extent an individual actually can care for and meet their needs independently. I'm certainly aware of the case law. Zebulon, I think, is an example where activities of daily living were addressed in the context of speculative and concern about minor injuries or accidents that were not sufficient to meet that. But I think courts of appeals have also acknowledged reasonably that this standard to prove dangerousness in a continued protective placement hearing doesn't require clairvoyance. And certainly the goal would be that Robert had a sufficient level of care and protection in an adult family home in the year preceding this order, such that he wouldn't be at imminent risk of harm. But Dr. Brahm's written report noted that he continues to use a walker, he's a fall risk, and disputes the purposes and effectiveness of his medication. And I know there was substantial discussion about medication, but I think the question, the operative question in my mind is not really what exact medications is he prescribed and would he take those exactly as they're being prescribed. The court's not a prescriber, the circuit court's not a prescriber for Robert, and neither is Dr. Brahm. But I think the question is really, if Robert were living independently in a less restrictive setting, could he meet those needs that an individual would need to do in an independent
and
setting?
Counsel, I think we have some concerns about whether there's enough evidence, you know, at the circuit court level, and whether or not dangerousness requirements an uphill battle for you or not, right? But I'd ask you to move on and talk about the permanency criteria, that is, that the individual has a disability that's permanent or likely to be permanent. Are you able to touch on that, please?
Yes. So in 2023, when the guardianship and protective placement orders were initially entered, there was a finding of permanence. And I agree with counsel that there was some discussion. I think Dr. Brahm was less equivocal in his oral testimony than he was in his written report. But ultimately, I think Dr. Brahm's testimony recognized reasonably that these are not necessarily a binary circumstance where someone is either meets the standard or does not, that there may be improvement, there may be change. He may see a period of improvement, but that doesn't mean it would negate his need for guardianship and protective placement. And Dr. Brahm was specifically asked if at the time of the hearing, he believed that Robert continued to need guardianship and protective placement, and he indicated that he did. And so while I think the possibility of a neuropsych eval and speech language training or other supportive services may reduce Robert's need for guardianship, may reduce his need protective placement, it doesn't mean that he no longer meets the standards or is no longer incompetent. And Dr. Brehm's testimony, I think, was sufficient to support that finding at the circuit court level.
So you're saying from when that initial emergency order was, you're saying that's enough to show permanence?
No, I'm not saying it's sufficient. I think the orders exist independently, and the county was obligated to prove those standards for protective placement.
Right. So if they're required to prove them now in a due process hearing, which they have the burden, and the doctor says he can't say if it's permanent or likely to be permanent, how has the county met the burden?
Well, I think he also testified, though, that in his opinion, Robert continued to need protective placement. And
right, that's a conclusory statement.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I do read Dr. Brehm's testimony, though, as acknowledging the possibility that this is not entirely stagnant, existing as the exact kind of circumstance or presentation that he presented within 2023. And so I think Dr. Brehm's testimony did address the possibility of change or improvement, but he was specifically asked if he believed he remained incompetent at the time of the hearing, and he indicated that he did. And I think part of...
Right, but that's not the future. He might remain it right now in this moment, but isn't the issue of permanency a future, more of a future issue? The disability has to be one that's not going to change. That's not the same question as he sits here today. Is he incompetent?
I take the point, and I agree with you. I do think, though, that the statute contemplates some protection and possibility of change. The statutory language for protective placement is permanent or likely to be permanent. And part of the issue here, I think, relates to the specific presentation of Robert and the aphasia, that Dr. Brehm had some concern that he may have had cognitive ability that was beyond what was being presented based on his inability to express that. But that doesn't negate the findings. And I would also note that I think in the 55 context, there is a built-in safety valve acknowledging that there's an annual review process that exists. So an individual has a right on an annual basis to have the guardian ad litem appointed as an independent decision maker and recommender. The individual has an annual right to be evaluated by an independent medical provider. That did happen in this case. And so it's not, for example, that there's a decision on permanency made that's never reviewed. It's likely to be permanent. I think that was the presentation at the time Robert was evaluated in 2024. There was the possibility, which was discussed, that he may experience improvement with certain therapies if he would consent to those and choose to participate. And I think that would be reviewed again at an annual review a year later, essentially.
Is there anything in the record to explain why someone who had a stroke was being administered psychotropic medication?
The Human Services Department did file a written report which included the summary of medications, but there's nothing specific in Dr. Brehm's report or testimony, nothing that was received into evidence as to any of the specific medications. And so when the court evaluates, there are four elements to protective placement being continued. Two are contested here, danger and permanence. Ultimately, there is, and the legislature has acknowledged, a delicate balance between protecting an individual from a risk of harm based on an inability to meet their own needs, but also recognizing that any care that's provided through the Chapter 54 and 55 systems must be done in the method that is least restrictive and impinges the least on an individual's right of choice and self-direction. And so ultimately, the case law has recognized that very few cases will present such specific harm as was discussed in Washburn County versus DCR, which was the motorcycle case. So for example, an individual suffered a traumatic brain injury in a motorcycle accident. And at the time the due process hearing occurred, he was indicating a request to purchase another motorcycle. And the court pointed to that as a very specific type of harm. But ultimately, I think Dr. Brehm's testimony about Robert's ongoing issues, presentation, continue to be a fall risk, and unwillingness to, inability to provide for his activities of daily living in a less restrictive setting is sufficient to meet that standard of dangerousness. So, but for the services or intervention continued, there would be the risk of harm that was, I think, presented initially when this case came into the hospital and then the circuit court system. And so, the in my opinion, the case presents an example of a multitude of social safety systems working together to prevent continued harm or further harm to Robert based on his presentation. And so the county's request is that the court, again, determine that the case is moot and clarify that SAM does not extend to Chapter 55 cases. And I would note the holding in SAM was context specific and limited to a Chapter 51 case. The court in SAM stated that the cost of care liability was a collateral consequence in a recommitment hearing. It didn't say that any statutory language referenced in 4610 can never be moot because of this liability that exists by operation of law. So under the approach that RPL asserts, mootness would be applied not just to 55 cases, but to all the other statutory schemes, which include, for example, 980 cases referenced under 4610. But if the court determines that the case is not moot or cost of care liability does apply here, I would ask the court to affirm the Court of Appeals based on the circuit court findings related to permanency and dangerous. I'm happy to answer any other questions if there are any.
What, if any, obligation did the county have to provide Robert with supports in his own home that would enable him to at least attempt to recover from the disabling condition that he has, which nobody really knows what it is? It's a cerebral event, but there's no MRI in the record, right? No one really knows what's wrong with Robert or why he can't speak. It's he had a stroke. Well, lots of people have strokes and they continue to live in their own homes. So my question for you again is, what, if anything, or what obligation did the county have to provide supports to maintain Robert in his home, assist him with activities of daily living while he's attempting to recover as he did once before from his stroke?
I would say as a general practice, there is an obligation by all parties, and I see my time has expired. May I briefly answer?
Please.
As a general obligation, I believe the county has a requirement, as all other parties in the system, to ensure that an individual has the least restrictive care available to them that's sufficient to meet their needs. I do believe these are expert-driven cases such that the initial order contemplated this level of care. The county filed a petition for annual review, and the report that came from this was that the level of care he was at was appropriate. So I don't believe the county had necessarily a specific obligation to controvert or go against maybe the examiner's recommendation. But at this hearing, were there findings that he may have done well in a less restrictive setting, then I think that would have been the initiation of the obligation for the county.
Any more questions?
We're good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal, please.
So I think what troubles me about this case, similar to how Robert is at the mercy of his system because he can't speak and he hasn't been given the means to do so, is the way in which he faces a kind of shifting set of opponents. We have the county, which is certainly allied with a broad suite of institutional actors, which are coordinating in this apparatus. But it seems like any time Robert attempts to push back against the county, the response is, it's not us, it's not our fault, it's not our problem. And I think that that's problematic because at the end of the day, Racine County was the petitioner in this action. They are the one driving the bus in the annual review process. And it is up to them to ensure that the record is complete and that there is sufficient evidence. And so merely saying, well, he wasn't really our witness, he was a court-appointed expert, well, he's their witness for the purpose of this hearing. And the defects in the record adhere to the county. And I think that they're ample, and we've discussed them at length. I don't need to belabor them. But I just think that this court needs to think critically about this situation as a nightmare scenario for older adults in Wisconsin, that this is what is at stake if an older adult living at home has a stroke, and that Robert now finds himself in a situation that should be concerning. And yes, he's not in a locked facility. I've been to the adult family living situation. I wouldn't say it's the most ideal setting in the world, but that's where he is. And at the end of the day, as I've stated, it's the county that has the burden. We have decades of case law indicating how significant a burden this is. We have numerous unpublished cases. And I guess I would just ask the court to follow that guidance and to find the evidence insufficient. No further questions. I'll sit down.
I don't see any further questions. Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. We are adjourned. The court's going to meet at 1:30 in court conference. And thanks to everyone who attended today.
Faith, you want to tell them to stick around? The students?
But Janet,
students know to stick
around? Sticking around?
The students?
I thought I did, yeah.
Ask them if they are, though. Get well,
are you all going to stick around for Justice Protasiewicz? Yes? Okay, I see some nods.
Okay, I'll see you in a couple minutes, okay?
You're gonna have to compete with the music.